Around the clock, around the world, Bloomberg keeps you connected on television, online, on the radio, and on mobile.
This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time for October 1st. My guest is Philip Hoare, biographer and historian, speaking with us today about the superlatives and impossibilities of the whale. Your book of that title, Philip, is A Voyage of Discovery, about the history of the American whaling industry, about Herman Melville and Moby Dick, about your own swimming in the open sea with a sperm whale. Maybe you can begin with these superlative anatomies of Leviathan.
I mean, the whale is an animal beyond all expectation and imagining, really. I mean, we're talking about the biggest animal that ever lived. We're talking about an animal, in the case of the sperm whale, with the biggest brain that's ever existed. We're talking about animals in the case of the blue whale, for instance, and the fin whale, which are the loudest animals. One fin whale can make a call on one side of the Atlantic and it'll be heard by another blue whale or fin whale on the other side of the Atlantic. They're also the longest lived of any animals. The bowhead whale, which is a huge, slow-moving, blubbery beast of the Arctic regions, has actually been proved now to survive for up to 250, maybe 300 years minimum. So everything about the whale is surrounded by superlatives. And as a writer, that's kind of difficult to write about in a way because you kind of quickly run out of superlatives. The bottom line is the thing about the whale is that it's ultimately elusive, because for any of your listeners who've been whale watching, they'll know how tantalizing it is to see a whale in the wild, because all you see sometimes is the snout or the back or the fin or the disappearing tail, or maybe even something as airy as its blow, its spout, which is really just condensed air. It's not even water. It's just extraordinary that our reaction, our observation, our interface, if you will, with these amazing animals is so tentative, so tantalizing. And I think that's one of the reasons why they remain such mysterious creatures to us, because we have to put them together in our heads. They're like a jigsaw puzzle, a kind of component picture of what the true animal below the surface might actually look like.
And that, of course, is the subject of Herman Melville's great novel, Moby Dick. I mean, the amazing, mysterious, spiritual as well as temporal properties of the whale.
Absolutely. I mean, Moby Dick, which was based on a real-life story and a number of real-life stories that Melville was drawing on after his own whaling voyage. He sailed from New Bedford, 1840, Christmas 1840, on his own first whaling voyage. And during that voyage, he heard so many stories. He heard the story of the Essex, the famous ship which was stove and sunk by a sperm whale out in the Pacific. The shipwrecked survivors were forced to cannibalize each other to survive. And he heard the story of Mocha Dick, who was a true-life whale off the coast of Chile, who was renowned for being ferocious and would turn and attack his own tormentors. And he knew at first hand the bloody butchery business of whaling, you know, this incredible industry which America was conducting. And after timber, it was America's greatest industry of the 19th century, of the early 19th century, certainly. They were like the cowboys of the sea, these guys. They were going out and harpooning these whales, sperm whales, of course, because those great pugnacious square heads of the sperm whale, and this is the whale that we all drew as kids, you know, that great block-headed beast. That head is full of the world's finest natural oil, an oil so fine that it's still used by NASA in the space program. So all these extraordinary stories for Melville, this is what he tried to convey in this book, which transcends literature, in my opinion. I think Moby Dick is a completely unique book. It exists beyond any other book, in a way, in the same way as the whale does.
In the 1840s in America, explain how big an industry it was.
Well, it was an enormous industry. At Melville's time, it was bringing in $70,000 into one port, New Bedford, alone each year. I mean, that's a massive amount of money. These ships would come back with 500 barrel loads of sperm whale oil. The guys who were making this money were absolute millionaires. But it's quite funny because a lot of them were Quakers. And of course, Quakers don't believe in ostentatious display of wealth. So they reinvested the money in the business. And it really was an enormous economy for America. It was the first time the American state had made its mark on a global economy. I mean, this is why American ships were going to the other side of the world, you know. And that's really the beginning of the American empire.
Talk about the ship Morgan, a whaling ship that you, in your travels, went aboard in Mystic, Connecticut. What does it look like? Describe it, and then describe the whale hunt.
Well, the fantastic thing about the Morgan, it's the only surviving whale ship, a Yankee whale ship, and it's actually contemporaneous with Moby Dick, so it's exactly the kind of ship that Melville would have sailed on. It's small, it's about 100 foot long. It's the 19th century equivalent of an oil tanker. It was built to kill and process whales. So small boats hung off davits off the side of the boat, off the big boat, the Morgan, would, when they've sighted whales, which they sight from the top of the mast, you know, literally the old cry, there she blows, they'd send the boats out, which are small, clinker-built, fragile craft, very fast, double-prowed, rowed by men who keep entirely silent during the hunt, because a sperm whale actually is an incredibly timid and placid creature and can be scared by the slightest noise. They'd row without shoes. They'd row with the rollocks of the oars muffled. And when they came on the whale, the boat steerer would stand at the prow of the ship and harpoon the whale. And that harpoon would be then towed by the whale. Of course, it's embedded in the whale's blubber. And then they would be towed. The ship would be towed on what was called the Nantucket Sleigh Ride, fastest man had ever travelled on water to that date. And after a long struggle, the whale itself would be lanced. It would be killed and then towed back to the ship, where it would be rendered down. The blubber would be stripped off its carcass like a giant orange sort of being unpeeled. That would be boiled down in great vats known as tryworks. And then that would be decanted into barrels. And the whole point of the voyage was to fill the ship as full as possible with sperm whale oil or other whale oil, and then brought back home. These voyages could take 2 to 3 to 5 years.
The conditions aboard were very cramped. I mean, how many in crew and what were their quarters like?
Oh, well, you know, for the crew themselves, I mean, the captain had his staterooms, and then the harpooners and the cook and the mates had their own separate cabins, sometimes shared cabins, but most of the crew were bunked in sort of really just big shelves, really, these sort of bunks, or sometimes hammocks, but more often kind of bunks, in the prow of the ship, right at the front end of the ship. Very uncomfortable, very little headroom, very dark, very smelly. These men were never clean. They were always covered in whale oil, and it was a filthy business.
The butchering of the whale, explain in that context the whale's metabolism, anatomies, properties, products that were taken from it.
The spermaceti oil was absolutely prized for its use in making candles. Their wax was processed into candles, which... That came out of the head, the great sort of square head. There were two reservoirs of spermaceti oil there. So that was used for candles and oil in lamps. Then the blubber itself was reduced down. That the thick, sort of almost like armor plating of the whale was then boiled down, and that was reduced into oil, or the oil was extracted from that. And that was used for less fine lighting, for lubrication. The meat wasn't used at all. The animal wasn't eaten at that point, you know, in the American whaling industry, absolutely not. Very occasionally they'd find ambergris, which is this extraordinary, very powerful material which is formed in the whale's gut as a reaction to the squids that it eats, the squid beaks that get caught in the gut. And that was actually used in the perfume industry and actually was worth more than its weight in gold.
But you say that the arteries of the whale are big enough for a man to swim in.
Well, for a boy to swim in, actually. The heart is as big as a medium-sized car. An African elephant could stand on the tail of a blue whale, for instance. I've seen right whales off the coast of Cape Cod. When they open their mouths, which are huge mouths filled with baleen, which they strain their food. The mouths, I mean, they're like a garage. You could drive a car in them. They are enormous creatures.
All right, over time, The whaling industry dies out in America at the end of the 19th century, and then what happens in the 20th century? What is the whaling hunt in the 20th century like?
Well, principally, what happened in the 20th century was this: with the invention of explosive harpoons, the faster whales, the whales which had eluded the Yankee whalers of the 19th century, the whales such as the blue whale and the fin whale, they became within reach. In fact, where the Yankee whaling fleet would sort of been put to bed by the early 20th century, by the latest, 1920, I think, is the last ship goes out, the fleets of Norway, of the Soviet Union, of Japan, Japan, of Scandinavia, and of Britain were all hunting whales, mostly in the Southern Ocean. That's where they were doing most of the hunting. And that was when the greatest cull was carried out. I mean, at least 750,000 whales died in the 20th century.
And they didn't do well in World War II. How so?
No, because the whales actually, they were used to make armaments. They actually made nitroglycerine from whales. Terribly ironic, these wonderful placid creatures were actually used in the pursuance of war itself.
And sometimes they were mistaken for submarines and bombed.
That's right, you know, and actually they would use whales for target practice. Navies would use whales for target practice. It's just a terrible thing.
What is the situation of the whaling industry today?
There's only really two big nations that still whale, which is Norway and Japan. Norway have never been signed up to the 1986 moratorium on whaling, which was declared by the International Whaling Commission. And Japan operate under supposedly scientific research, in inverted commas. In fact, they're killing whales, and those whales are entering the food chain. They're being eaten, sold in restaurants, eaten in schools even. Whale meat is eaten in school lunches in Japan. And this is a great problem, obviously, because, you know, although the whales, most of the whales they're killing are whales such as minke whales, which are quite prolific whales, they're also threatening to kill humpback whales. They already do kill sperm whales, which are much more endangered. That's certainly a cause for concern.
Talk a little about the whale and the human imagination today. Whales are beloved creatures, and most people respond to them with great affection, but that was not always so.
No, and I think that's a very good point, because actually it's the discovery that the whales sang, that humpback whales, for instance, sang, which they were recorded by an American scientist called Roger Payne. If any one person could have been said to have saved the whale, it's Roger Payne, because he recorded the song of the humpback whale and released it as an album, which made the album charts, the pop charts, in the 1970s. And that really sensitized human beings to the fact that these animals did have a voice. And it's such a plangent song. It's a very haunting thing that if you've ever heard it, it really stays with you. And that, I think, you know, sort of personalized the predicament of the whale. Because up until that point, you know, whales have been regarded as a resource, as an industrial resource. And as a monster, certainly in medieval times, when it was believed that you could actually sail off the end of the earth, the outer reaches of the ocean, which were unexplored, were full of these monstrous spouting creatures with horns and grinning teeth and all sorts of things like that. You know, of course, it's the whole notion of Jonah being swallowed by the whale and all these mythical representations of the whale, because obviously people didn't know what they really looked like. And I think that's still true today. I mean, actually, you know, the sperm whale wasn't filmed underwater before man landed on the moon. We knew what the Earth looked like from outer space before we knew what a sperm whale looked like underwater. It's still a very recent science.
You traveled all over the world in your discovery of the whale. You went to Nantucket, you went to Connecticut, Britain, and so on. But eventually you find yourself swimming with a whale. Where was that, and describe it?
Well, this was in the Azores, which was one of the famous sort of calling points for the old Yankee whaling fleets. They'd call there to hunt whales and also stock up on supplies and crews. And because of that, the Azorians learnt to whale just the same way as the Yankees did, the same process. They only stopped whaling there in 1986, in fact. So when I went there, which is a couple of years ago, I've been there a few times, but there are still whale bones on the beach left over from the whaling factories. But now it's an amazing place to go watching whales. And because it's the Azores are really just the tips of volcanoes rising from the mid-Atlantic ridge, they're very good deep waters for sperm whales to feed in, and sperm whales feed at great depth on squid. And it was there we went to film whales. And actually, the idea was to film me in the water with whales. Well, we came upon a pod of 12 to 14 sperm whales at the surface. And the young Portuguese guy in charge of the Zodiac, the small motorized boat we were in, said, look, this is the best opportunity you are going to ever have of filming these animals. They're not usually this docile and this near. So we got in the water, and I was meant to be being filmed as I was sort of approaching these whales. The person who was filming me actually had a bit of a panic attack. She had to be pulled out of the water. And I started blithely swimming on towards these whales, which were sort of, I guess, sort of 500 yards ahead of me. But the visibility there was very small, and I was snorkeling. And the visibility was only about 20 feet. So I was 20 feet away from these animals before I actually saw them. So my entire vision was just wall-to-wall whale. And at that point, one of the whales, and I now realize this was probably the matriarch of the group, you know, the biggest female whale of the group, detached itself from the pod and started swimming towards me. Well, I've never been so scared in all my life. My heart was beating against my ribcage. I could literally feel it. And the whale was coming in closer and closer, and I thought, okay, this whale, I know sperm whales have very little vision. They really don't operate by vision. It's eyes at the side of its head. It can't see me. And I thought, it's either going to swim into me or it's going to open its mouth at the last moment. And sperm whales are the only whale that can and indeed have swallowed human beings. So at this point, I lost control of my bodily functions. I felt, rather than heard, I felt the whale's sonar moving through my skull, through my sternum, through my whole skeleton. And it was echolocating me. It was like I was in a huge MRI scan. It was actually creating a three-dimensional sound picture of me in its head, which it was bouncing back to itself. It was actually reading me in the water. Kind of ironic, because I'd spent 5 years trying to describe whales, and here was a whale trying to describe me. And at that moment, it just turned on its side, and it was as close to me as this microphone is now. I mean, I could have easily reached and touched it, but that was a kind of a distance I couldn't breach. And it looked at me straight in the eye, this huge whale eye. And the amazing thing was that this eye was sentient. It was understanding me. And that was what was so extraordinary, I suppose. And then it dove. It just dove perpendicularly from the blue down into the black. And sperm whales can dive for a mile down and can stay down for 2 hours. And it just vanished. I remember almost laughing to myself because it just seemed so unreal. It was almost like a CGI recreation of an animal, of all my imaginings, actually, since a boy and all the things I'd imagined about whales. I was there, but it was almost unbelievable.
Sperm whales are affectionate. They like to touch one another and roll around and play. Have you seen evidence of that?
Oh, absolutely. I was in Kaikoura in New Zealand earlier this year, where there's a good population of sperm whales, and they are very social animals. They're as social as African elephants, which is quite an interesting analogy from an animal behavioural point of view. The males will actually grip young calves in their mouths, and these are, you know, the males have got big teeth, but they grip them very tenderly in their mouths, almost sort of in lieu of an embrace. They're very tactile creatures. They roll around in the water, feeling each other, reassuring each other by touching one another. They're highly socialized animals.
Do we know whether they are also wise and highly intelligent? We make guesses at that. Certainly Melville did.
Yeah, well, and he was very prescient in what he said, because, you know, whale science is very recent. It's only past 30 years we've been seriously studying these animals. And the sperm whale's brain is the biggest brain, as I said, of any animal that's ever existed. It weighs up to 18 pounds. But it has, and you might say in proportion to the animal, well, that's all well and good. But in fact, the neocortex of the sperm whale is highly convoluted. And that means there's a lot of surface area at the real business end of the brain. And that indicates the capability for emotions, for tool use, for communication, and for abstract thought. So we can only hypothesize, but scientists do believe that the sperm whale is capable of all those things. And recently it was decided, posited, that the toothed whales, of which the sperm whale is one, the dolphin is another, possibly rank after human beings in intelligence and before primates. So we are talking about animals which are probably highly intelligent.
You also have a last thought in your book that it's conceivable that whales might inherit the Earth. How so?
Well, it's just a sort of fantasy, I think. and it's one which Melville posited back in 1851. He talked about the time when the world was all ocean. Well, it's not impossible the world might be all ocean again in the not too far distant future. You do wonder if the whales, you know, as superior evolutionary beings, might well just regain their watery empire.
With that glorious thought, thank you, Philip Hoare, for speaking with us today about the whale and its magnificences. This is Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2010.